there are two different ways you might have experienced mini golf at the Nelson Atkins this Memorial Day weekend. You might have actually gone and tried the course with its 9 holes scattered in the sculpture park, or you could have logged on to really any social media site to see other people's pictures of the experience. And I'm going to go ahead and give a shout out to the hole that looks like a mini Nelson Atkins building complete with mini shuttlecocks. It is very meta, and the pictures are awesome. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking with Julian Zugasagoitia about the art course at the Nelson and whether it represents a changing role for the museum in our city. Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in on the changes you've seen. 816-235-2888. Julian, good morning.
Good morning.
How'd opening weekend go for the new mini golf edition?
I just got the numbers, and it's just sublime numbers. And
sublime.
I mean, unexpected. And also, we're introducing, as of this weekend, we are opening now Mondays. And
yes.
So yesterday was our first Monday that we were open. And by that, by virtue of that, we're giving access to a lot of people that work on the weekends and have not come to the museum before. So for us, opening Mondays is going to be something that we're trying out through the summer, and hopefully we can keep it going if people respond to it. But yesterday, 2,300 people. So it's just a great, great, great number for us.
So here's the deal. People playing mini golf on a museum lawn is super fun. You're not going to get any argument from me on that. But clearly you know that nobody even needs to set foot inside the museum to enjoy it. Same goes for the big street party on Rock Hill Road the previous weekend. There
Correct.
Was live music, there were food trucks. And I'm going to be up front. People not going inside the museum to see the art does not bother me a lick. The question is, does it bother you as a museum director?
So what we're trying to do with whether it's the concert or the mini golf is give people that have never come to the museum before options to approach us. And so I believe that already experiencing the campus of the Nelson Atkins, walking around the sculpture park, already gives you access to some incredible sculptures that we have. And maybe the curiosity leads you inside the museum. So the art course, once you take it and once you start filling in the card to say how many holes strikes you've done, you'll see that it sends you also in a scavenger hunt to see and seek the original works of art that inspired those holes inside. And if you do that, then you get also a pin as a reward. So we're trying to encourage going inside. But on the other side, if you just come to enjoy it and have a good experience, that's fine too.
Tell me the story of the art course. Where'd the idea come from?
Actually, the idea came from, we're not the first museum doing it, but you always have to steal good ideas from others. And, Minneapolis, the Walker Art Center had one. And Karen Christensen, who is our COO, had a meeting of all of the administrators and COOs of various museums. And I remember in her backyard, he was receiving them and hosting them. And I was talking to the CEO, and he was telling me about the incredible numbers that the mini golf make for them and how it also changed the perception of the museum as a much more accessible. And in that conversation, Casey Claps, who also works in my office, came and I said, this is something you should look into. And Casey really ran with the project, and it is really her doing. It took us 2 years to discuss and see how.
But what was appealing about it? What was it about what they were doing in Minneapolis, what that added to the museum experience that really intrigued you?
So what it intrigued us is making the museum, again, attractive to an audience that might have not otherwise thought of coming to the museum. And so the playfulness of this. Now, I think we have a claim to the playfulness already in the campus just because it was very controversial 30 years ago when the shuttle courts first appeared in our sculpture park. A lot of people reacted negatively, thinking pop art should not be in the Nelson Atkins, or this form of art, Claes Oldenburg and the shuttle courts, is not what I see as art, you know? And I think that was predicated on a view that art was closer to the Rodin thinker than anything else.
Or that art is serious.
Or that art is serious, for that matter. So the mini golf, the idea that we did, now we created our own version of it, first inviting people to submit holes inspired by our collection. So the tie to our collection is very important, even essential. That is original to us. We made it as a competition open to people, and I think children from 7, 8 year olds competed, and then very elderly people competed. And then the selection from 100 submissions or around 100 submissions were these 9 holes, and representing a good range of collections from the Nelson Atkins and people who submitted. And so what I think we're attempting here is, again, to change the nature and following what artists do. Artists are always redefining what art is. And so what we're trying to do is, following that lead, is redefining what a museum experience can be.
So along those lines, when it comes to highbrow versus lowbrow, I personally embrace no brow as my ethos. Like, honestly, who cares if something is interesting to you and you like it? Why should it matter? But I will say that historically, art museums have been considered highbrow and Putt-Putt has not. And I'm curious about whether you've gotten any feedback along those lines.
Well, there was the feedback early on when we first introduced the idea, even to our closest allies, that are our board members. And there was a reaction, even just because the name Mini Golf or Putt-Putt has that kind of very, very lowbrow. And it's like, well, it's going to be a different experience. So we took time to address those concerns and to make sure that even among our closest friends, they understood what was attempted. I think also in the visualization of this, Hallmark was instrumental. We had access to their creative teams, and they helped us even come up with branding and look and the name Art Course and some of the taglines between. So it's just there is a level of sophistication and work to make it happen that I think fulfills today one, the aspirations of excellence that the Nelson Atkins is known for in every form and everything we do. And on the other side, satisfied a very ICSI access into a game that all of a sudden reveals works of art in a way that you had not seen them before.
You've alluded to this, but the lawn of the Nelson has undergone a lot of change in just my lifetime. And so far, I agree with you. The biggest change is the shuttlecocks. Even though a lot of change has come since then, that was a watershed kind of moment, I think. Before the shuttlecocks, the museum's exterior was very stoic, and it was grand, but maybe a little foreboding if you had never been inside. I could definitely imagine that. As controversial as the shuttlecocks were, and for some people I think still are, the shuttlecocks did change that. As you've said, they really invited play and set the stage for the rest of what's happened.
And I think they opened the door, and it was very courageous at the time of commissioning that. I think a lot of credit goes to Morton Sausland and his family for commissioning that. And again, it was the controversy that ensued, the attacks, I think just made the institution stronger in their belief of contemporary art too, which was, I think, something novel for the institution. But it allowed also a transformation of a generation to think about art today in a different way and a playful way, too.
And to think about this physical space in a different way. I think, you know, okay, so pre-golf, like a week ago, the Nelson lawn had really evolved to become the city's lawn. People have been taking their family photos there, enjoying picnics, playing frisbee, even just like tons of people descending and doing yoga on their own free will. The idea that this lawn needed another draw, I will be honest and say it's something I don't totally buy.
No, the lawn itself might not need it. The museum as a proposition perhaps will benefit from it. So it's not that we needed it in terms both on making it more accessible. We have enough programs. We have the big picnic coming up, actually. We have many ways that we have been inviting the community to take advantage of what it is, the museum that is 24 hours always open.
And this place in the middle of the city, this big lawn.
Yeah. But it was yet another way of giving access to our collections. And again, I emphasize the fact that each hole is an inspiration on our collections and an invitation then to go inside to look at the reference for those works of art and to start having in your mind also the notion that you can interpret things. I think it's a playful way also of giving you access to the collections. And to our great surprise, for instance, the one that was interpreted a lot was Kandinsky's painting because of the notion of synesthesia. So that we had a lot of submissions based on that particular work of art. So that tells you also that people were looking intently at our collection to make submissions, which was part of the exercise.
So how does this fit into the bigger picture of not just what the Nelson is and the role the Nelson wants to fill in our community, but what museums are becoming more generally, like in cities nationwide?
Well, I think we're part of leading a trend in that museums have to be closer to its publics. You know, and trying to, in a way, inspire more than to teach. If there was one change that you're seeing all over and at the Nelson also, we're going from being teaching platforms to being learning opportunities. Anyone can come at any level of knowledge or liking art and enjoy it in their own terms. And I think we're giving now more and more the opportunity of people just coming on their own terms. There's going to be enough to instill curiosity. And if we are successful in instilling curiosity and people want to come back, that's all we care. That people enjoy their moment, that they know it's free, that they can come in and out for 5 minutes or 5 hours. The museum is free
but
as an experience.
But the mini golf is not free.
No, the mini golf is an experience you have to pay for, yes.
And so I guess that when you said that this is something the museum can benefit from, I get the feeling you meant largely programmatically, but also is it an opportunity to be like a revenue-generating?
It is totally a revenue-generating opportunity that we're also benefiting and starting. And also people are, for instance, joining membership. If you become a member, you have advantages to play mini golf. And one of the things I want to remind everyone also is that when we charge for a special exhibition, we're opening 30 Americans soon, or mini golf, or the parking lot. All that revenue allows us to be free for the entire collection for the rest of the year. So we are...
Yeah, it has to come from somewhere.
We're capitalizing on those opportunities. And again, I just heard that there were new members becoming members to play and access art golf quicker. But it is... I hope for those people who have never been involved with us and become a new member that they start enjoying all of the rest that the museum has to offer.
So a few years ago on a trip to New York, I went to PS1. That's a contemporary branch of the MoMA that's located in Queens. And I was interested in seeing a specific work of art there. I did not know that Saturdays in the summertime are big parties at PS1. So no free admission that day because the event was ticketed. But the courtyard outside the museum was just a total scene. There was live music. People were hanging out, drinking, dancing, a lot of young hip people, a lot of families. It was super fun. But the action, again, was mostly outside the museum itself. And what I thought was cool about that was that I got to go to a party and I got to have the art basically to myself.
That's a great analogy. And I think we all are becoming multi-sensory experiences, no? It's music, it is dance, it is, in the case of PS1, they commission also a pavilion outdoor every year, something that is so neat. And people come to experience something together. And not unlike our Third Thursdays, if you come to the Nelson on a Third Thursday, you'll have a band, you'll have music indoors. Sometimes we take it outdoors too. But those are events that to make that your familiarity with the institution makes it that you can use it on a quotidian, on an everyday basis, that there's different reasons to come. As much as also there's different publics, you know. Third Thursdays is definitely skews younger. Everyone can come, but it is bringing younger people that maybe 20 years from now will prefer not to come on a Third Thursday.
You know, this trip to PS1 was before Third Thursdays had really exploded. And I remember kind of wondering why museums at home weren't trying to fill that more social role. But now that it is, as you've pointed out, Third Thursdays, that is its own scene at the Nelson in the evenings. And it does strike me that part of what it seems to me museums are doing is making themselves homes, kind of like making themselves places where people feel at home and feel comfortable, which is so different. There's never been an official rule that you have to be quiet in a museum. That whole like shushing in the library, that's never technically been a thing in a museum, but people think it is. And Third Thursdays is so loud, which is part of the intriguing thing, is that idea of make yourself at home. Make noise.
Enjoy it as you wish. You know, I think that is the message there, is that you can come at the museum and be yourself, and there's no dress code, and you can come whatever you want, and you can, you know, while we're open in open hours, come and go. It's free, and you can experience 5 minutes a gallery, be with your best friend, work of art, be by yourself. I think what we're trying to give is people the permission to experience it in their whatever way they want. And as much as certain people my age have visited and explored museums in a certain way, that is not the only way, you know? And I perhaps enjoy more museums by myself. I have the luxury sometimes of having colleagues that open museums of hours so I can see a show or something. But that is maybe too much a passion that has become that I want to see a show or look at the works of art. What you get more and more in museums is it's a communal experience, not unlike also going to a baseball game or a football game. It is far that you're together experiencing something. And
can I just jump in and say, do you think that's partly because people have a sense of being able to see the art online, digital searches? And I get mm-hmm. that it's not the same, but you have that sense of having other ways to see images.
I think the fact that you can see and access images digitally only enhances the experience when you see them in person. No, it's just you.
Right, but does that change what is actually going to get someone's feet in the door at the museum to have that social experience?
I think the notion that you can enjoy it with others is positive. I think we are gregarious animals by sort, and so we do want to see it with others. We want to share our emotions with others. We want to make sure that other people look or feel the same way. And sometimes the passion that we bring into those things, you can see it when someone is pointing out at a painting and, you know, saying like, hey, look at this. I wanted to show you this. But also what's beautiful about that is that each of us reverberate, or each of us have our favorite paintings. You know, even if all of the works are masterpieces at the Nelson Atkins, not all talk to you. And so when you go with family or friends and each of you is sharing which one you like best, it becomes a very social interaction. And it's a way also of revealing yourself, of sharing who you are, what you like, why you like this better than others. And there's that leads to wonderful conversations.
Some people really credit the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao for making museums aware of this kind of potential to play a role in the social fabric of the city that isn't just a benefit to the people going there. It can transform the city itself.
Totally. And I am part of the, if I'm today here in directing a museum in Kansas City, is because of the impact that Bilbao had on me in many ways, insofar that when it opened, and it opened at the same time, more or less a few months apart, than the Getty Center, for which I was, at the time I was working as a consultant for the Getty, and I saw the energy and what it had done for its city. And
yeah, a fishing village that wasn't a big draw for people from outside the village before.
It was
that.
An industrial, exactly. It was fishing and then industrial, and after the industrialization, it was a city that had lost a lot of its vibrancy and a modern infrastructure. And it was not only the Bilbao Guggenheim Museum, there's other infrastructures, but that was the most salient one. And also, in 1997, when it opened, it all proved that architecture could be something different than very rectilinear lines, you know, that you could have whimsical shapes and forms that you had never expected before. And all of a sudden, that was the viral. And globally, everyone knew of Frank Gehry and about this building. But there was an energy there. There was an energy that did transform a city. But it was also an openness to what architecture can be, what art and contemporary art, because that is also skewed contemporary. It's the collections of the Guggenheim. But it put a lot of things in motion And I tell you, I'm the beneficiary of that, having worked then at the Guggenheim, just because of the inspiration of that building.
Do you see the potential for the Nelson to have a transformative effect on Kansas City? It's a place that's been here for a long time, but as it changes, its role in the city changes.
I think the museum has and plays a similar role in different scales, and the city is a different scale too. But definitely the opening 10 years ago of the block building has had that effect. Our ability to program differently has had that effect also. And in the last 10 years, we've doubled the attendance. So definitely the fact that we're more welcoming is permeating. And now, I tell you, I want to just celebrate the fact that thanks to our board and a lot of donors, we're going to be open one more day a week on Mondays. So Tuesdays will going to be our closed day. But Mondays will give us access also to people who work on the weekends or who could not otherwise come, or people who visit for a long weekend and have Mondays off.
I have a very important question I need to jump in and ask.
Yes.
How is your mini golf game? Are you good?
You know, I've not played yet, just because I'm watching everyone else do it. And then the more I watch them play, the more I think I should not do it.
Why? Because you're afraid you're going to
not. I'm very bad.
Julian Zugasagoitia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julian is the director of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. He talked to us today about the mini golf course that just opened up on the museum's legendary lawn. And if you have already been golfing and you want to share your pictures on Twitter, pictures or it didn't happen, we are at KCURCST. Up next, the sculptor who is bringing Harry Truman back to D.C. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And my next guest is Tom Corbin. He's the artist who was chosen to cast Harry Truman in bronze now that the president from Independence has gotten his place in Statuary Hall. The process of getting him there politically lasted 2 decades. Now that it's in the artist's hands, the questions I have are about what he's going to look like once he's there. Tom Corbin, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you very much for having me today.
What is Statuary Hall?
Statuary Hall is a collection of 100 monuments. Let me back up a little bit in the respect that each state is given 2 sculptures that they can contribute to Statuary Hall. And so that, since there's 50 states, there's 100 sculptures there right now. And part of Statuary Hall would include the crypt, the Statuary Hall itself, and the rotunda. So there's 3 different locations, actually.
So this is not like electoral votes. Every state gets the same number.
Exactly. But the state pays for everything. So, so it was a good way back when they started this for the Capitol to be decorated without the federal government having to spend a dime.
Smart.
Yes.
Okay. So what does it mean for Harry Truman to be headed there?
Well, they will be replacing one of their monuments, which would be Thomas Hart Benton, the senator from Missouri from the mid-1800s. And Emanuel Cleaver was the one that spearheaded this project. I think it started 5 or 6 years ago. And so I think perhaps a president would trump a senator in this case.
So I understand that Truman's family chose you to create Truman's likeness for this project. Tell me about that process of being chosen and becoming involved.
Well, the family was part of it, but it's actually the Truman Library Institute put together a committee, a selection committee, and they were the ones that initially considered all the proposals that were presented to them. They picked the 4 finalists, and then the grandson of Harry, Clifton Daniels, was part of that selection committee. So there was a number of cooks, I guess, stirring the soup in this case.
So when you decided to submit a proposal, what was going through your head?
Well, I had done, when I was first starting out my career back in the late 80s, I was doing a lot of commission work, a lot of representational pieces that were Firefighters Memorial, for example, and a lot of heroic things, a lot of, there was the Korean Vietnam War Memorial at Wyandotte County. So a lot of that style of sculpture was part of my bailiwick, you know, at one time. And so I figured, you know, this would be the ultimate, is to be able to put a place and put a piece in the Capitol in that tradition.
What were you thinking about how Truman would be portrayed? Because I don't think when we see these kinds of sculptures, these like honorific sculptures portraying famous people long past, I don't think we often stop and consider that this is a person who lived a whole life. The sculptor has chosen what age that person appears to be in the sculpture. That sculptor has chosen the position someone's standing
Correct.
In, the facial expression and mood.
Uh-huh.
Out of a whole lifetime, really, of options.
Right,
I'm
right.
sure that Truman has felt every emotion, and he's been he was a lot of different ages, etc.
That's correct. Well, we were supposed to put him in the, as far as his looks, as he would have appeared as during his presidential years. We had the luxury of having the Truman Library, you know, over in Independence. And so we made multiple trips over there, worked with the archivist there.
And who's we?
We would be my vice president, Julia Velasquez. And so we would go back and forth and, as I mentioned, work with the archivists. And they would actually bring out pieces of Harry's apparel during his presidency. And it was fascinating, you know, whether they'd be his famous hat or his double-breasted suits, his glasses, whatever. And so that was very helpful. And we were also given very exacting dimensions. In fact, we came across one document from Madame Trousseau's wax museum in Paris asking for his dimensions. So those were all spelled out there. So that was pretty interesting.
When you came to make these kinds of decisions
okay.
for yourself, for your own proposal,
right.
what were you thinking about?
Well, we knew Poe's was significant. You know, it was very important to get it right.
Pose.
Yeah, the pose. And we then researched the sculptures at Stairchery Hall, and we found that what I found not totally what I thought they were very stoic and not necessarily approachable. And I think that would be the antithesis of the way people considered Harry Truman. He was a man of the people. He's out walking all the time and a man in motion. So we wanted to communicate that sense of motion. But we had to do it on a small platform. And the best way we decided to do that is by having him descending a staircase as if to greet you as you come into Statuary Hall.
But the other statues in Statuary Hall are not in motion?
Actually, they're not. Well, there might be a little bit of motion, but when we have talked to some of the officials from the Capitol Architects, they said, there's nothing like it there right now. So we were excited about that.
And was there any resistance to Truman standing out from the crowd in this way?
No, everybody's embraced it. And so at least as far as I know.
So when you went through the process of making these kinds of decisions and seeing things in the Truman Library and in the museum and in the archives, can you talk about specific things you saw that really inspired you?
Well, I, in addition to going to the library, also read David McCullough's book on Truman, and I thought I knew quite a few things about Truman, but I really it was minimal when it got.
You
right
did
to.
Not know hundreds of pages worth already.
That's true. That's true, and so. You know, from him going from having no political experience at all, and with his backing, of course, with the Pendergast regime, getting him to the Senate initially, and then from going from that to vice president, which was unlikely, and then getting the call that FDR had passed away, all these unlikely events had occurred. He was a very unlikely president, but he really came through in all of those situations.
And does that inspire you personally? How does that kind of information find its way into a bronze statue?
Well, I think if he, you know, would have any control over the way he would be portrayed, he would want to look like the common man. And I think outside of his double-breasted suit, which I don't think everybody wears, I think outside of that, that would be communicated in the way I presented him in the pose.
Do you think, so I'm looking at an image of this sculpture, and he's in step, but he also, his shoulders are down and like kind of one arm is hanging down a little lower than the other. And so that causes the suit to crease a little bit. Is that part of the approachability?
That was part of it. His arm is actually extended as if to come out to shake your hand. And And yeah, I wanted to for it to look very natural. It's funny though that you mentioned the creases in the suit, where a few members of the committee decided for me to tone that down a little bit. So in addition to being sculptor, I was also tailor. In this case,
because it does accentuate the poncho a little.
Well, okay, but anyway, I actually was the model for this. I bought
what?
A full length mirror. Oh, I just couldn't recruit any of my friends to stay all day for me to sculpt them. So I was the model that had to put on my suit every day, and now I have clay all over my suit from doing the maquette.
Well, so. When I think about the artistic process, just generally, I think about so many of my friends who are artists who love the open-endedness of that, who love creating their own vision. The process that you're describing is very much how does this letting this person be your guide and letting all the people who have sort of a vested interest in this person's legacy also decide, and then fulfilling other people's vision on some level. But you seem very creatively inspired by that.
Well, since I never knew the president, I was more than open to people that actually have had that experience, especially the grandson, Clifton Daniels. So a lot of it was just guessing when I started out. And there were some, after I think you were looking at the photograph of my original maquette, there have been subtle changes to his face, things that I was, again, guessing at.
Can you give an example?
Well, his face was a little fuller than what I portrayed initially. His chin was different, was a little shorter, and I realized I needed to make it a little fuller. Just very simple things like that. But and I also would, after I presented my maquette, I'd come by new pictures. I'd go, oh, if I only had that photograph when I was working on the piece, I would have, included this and whatever. So it's still, this is just a maquette or a working study. The most important thing is when we start work on the actual monument, the monumental clay, which will be in the neighborhood of 8 feet tall.
8 feet tall?
Uh-huh.
How is that going to change things for you?
It will actually, working on a monument that big, as far as working on the face, is much easier working on a face at that scale than working on a tiny little head. And so I'm excited to work on that. And I can have, for example, the glasses will be much more authentic than my little pieces of copper wire that I have right now. And so you're actually, what I describe as getting into the face, it's a lot easier. So the detail will be accentuated with the bigger one.
You're also kind of describing not just an artistic process, but the process of getting to know someone and spending time with them. Because you're talking about, I never met Truman. So you're talking to people Truman knew. You're reading books about him. And then you're spending time with this physical maquette that you're creating. But you're spending time with this person's face and with this person's personality and story. Is it going to be weird to say goodbye to Truman?
Well, you know, when you have some in-laws that might have stayed too long. No, it's been great. It's I've never spent this much time on one piece. I guess you could say I could sculpt the president in my sleep at this point, because I know so much about not only his face, but his stature and whatever. And so the exciting part is now getting to do the larger one. There was so much that I was able to learn through doing the maquette. So it's actually going to be a lot more free-flowing, I think, in this case, where I was stopping and starting to do a lot of consulting with all my research materials and photos that we got from the Library Institute.
But now you know Truman.
I do. I do.
What's your favorite Truman story?
I think I was most impressed is when he was first a senator and the World War II had started, and he was the one that put together the committee that controlled all the costs, that the overruns or the bribes and things that were taking place through various companies and departments and whatever. So he really cleaned up the financing of the war. And so I think that gave him a lot of credibility in the Senate, and went on from that to where he was considered to be, for the vice president position.
So your favorite story isn't set on a farm in Independence? Or
those were good stories, too. As far as him being really a family man, where he went out and started building a career on his own in banking, and I guess he was a haberdasher at one time, but his dad fell on hard times, and he actually went back to the farm to work with his dad and pulled it out of this dire situation and made it successful again. So there were so many parts of his life that were significant that people aren't aware of.
Have you read the book about his years after the presidency when he went on a big road trip?
I have not. I have not.
Because I guess presidents didn't used to leave with like security details,
exactly.
Stuff like that. So he had a car and he and his wife went on a road trip around these United States, which is
Great. That's great.
It shows an actual love of the country on some level.
Yeah. Well, I knew when he was in D.C., he would take walks with, you know, maybe once one person of security, you know, he'd be taking walks around the mall and whatever and not think a thing of it. So
when is it that this sculpture is going to actually be in Statuary Hall?
At this point, there's no specific timeline. Next year is the 75th anniversary of Harry Truman being president. So that would be great if we could get installed then. But we really don't know at this point. Because it is the U.S. government, there's a lot of hoops that have to be jumped through. And I'm not part of that part. So you'd have to probably talk to somebody at the Truman Library Institute. But whenever it comes, I'm ready to install. I'll be anxious to get it done.
Tom Corbin, thanks so much and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I'm Gina Kaufman. In just a minute, we're going to hear how the K stacks up with ballparks nationwide. Our producer is visiting all 30 stadiums. Before she turns 30, she'll hit the last one on Saturday when the Royals play Dallas. This is KCUR Central Standard. Stay tuned. We're back, and I love that. Only a 40% chance of a thunderstorm. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're dragging our producer out from behind the glass. Melody Rowell turns 30 in just a few weeks, and she set a goal when she was a young lass of seeing a game in every Major League Baseball stadium in the U.S. Well, her 30th birthday is her self-imposed deadline, and it's almost here. So with just one stadium to go, we're going to hear what she's learned. Melody Rowell, hello.
Good morning.
Tell us about this dream and its origins.
So, I mean, technically, you could say it started when I was a kid. I think the first stadium I went to was the Atlanta Braves when I was maybe like 9. But it started more formally when I was living in D.C. and I went to go visit a friend in Philly, and the Washington Nationals were playing in Philly. So we decided to go to a game. And while we were sitting there, I was feeling kind of high and mighty about how many ballparks I'd been to. And I started counting. I was like, I've probably done like half. And I counted and I'd done 6. But then I started thinking about how many were on the East Coast, how easy it is to get places from D.C., and at the time, so this was 2015, so I would have been a young lass of 26. And it was like, I bet I could do this. And then I put it on Instagram. And once you put it on Instagram, then you're committed to it.
So it's become a project. Are there favorite moments you've had on this journey so far?
There have been so many. It's been so fun to build memories with my family. I've kind of dragged them along to some, along with some other friends. I've done some on my own, but one of the highlights was when I went to go see the Nationals play the Mets in New York, and they're big rivals. They're in the same division. I hated going to Nationals games when the Mets were there because the fans were just so obnoxious. So then I was one of those obnoxious fans who went to New York to watch the Nationals play the Mets.
Wait, in what way were you obnoxious? I need to know.
Well, I mean, I am the only Nats fan as far as the eye can see. Like, normally when I go to a game where one of my teams is playing, you spy a few other fans. You kind of give each other, like, the nod.
Because you're wearing, like, the jerseys?
Yeah. Like, you're wearing Royals t-shirts. Or you're wearing Nationals t-shirts.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was not the case at this game. I was the only Nationals fan that I saw the whole night. And that night, Max Scherzer, who is my favorite pitcher, threw a no-hitter. And if you are not a baseball person, that's a really big deal. It's very rare.
You're looking at my blank face looking back at you.
Yeah. It means that he pitched the entire game, which is kind of rare in itself, and not a single batter that he faced got a hit off of him. So it's huge. And I was losing my mind. I couldn't, you know, we're coming to like the last inning, the last few outs, and I'm standing up clutching my face because I think I'm about to see this historic thing. And when he completed the game, the whole stadium just falls silent except for me screaming my head off because I just saw a no-hitter. And then everybody around me is just glaring at me. And I know I'm being that fan, but I couldn't help it.
What is it like to see not just baseball this way, but the country this way? What does America look like through the lens of baseball stadiums?
It's kind of the great equalizer. I've been to so many cities now that I never would have considered a destination hotspot. I'm, you know, not trying to offend anybody, but why would I go to Cincinnati? And now I've been to Cincinnati, had a lovely time, beautiful place, drove across Ohio. It was gorgeous. And it's sort of this, I don't know, I kind of view the stadiums as this like welcome mat to the city. It's like you're going there with this purpose. Everybody who's there is loving what's happening in front of them. And you get to see, it's the same kind of pride that everybody has in their city, even if other people would say, like, why would I ever go to Cincinnati? Everybody who's there is like, I love Cincinnati. I love my team. And it's that same fervor that you see in every city.
Are there things that you've learned by doing this that you hadn't really set out to learn?
I mean, I've learned a lot about the game. I've learned a lot about how people are going to perceive a woman on her own keeping score at a game.
Tell me more.
You get a lot of old men trying to explain things to you.
There's a term for that.
Yes, they try to mansplain things to you. But I've also had, because I've been alone for some of these games, I think that has made me a little more approachable for good or for ill. And I've had women actually ask me why I'm keeping score. So I have this notebook that you write down, you track what's happening in the game. And it's a thing that it's sort of like a dying art, but I love doing it. And so sometimes I'll get seated next to some women or next to kids even, and they'll ask me what I'm doing and I can kind of like teach them and show them, and whether or not they ever do it themselves.
What is your answer to why you're doing it?
Oh, there's not a good answer. I find it kind of meditative because it does take concentration.
Because this dates back to when there wouldn't have been the technology to have the score constantly flashing up on the
screen.
Right,
yeah. And so you're tracking what every batter does when they go up to the plate, how they get out or how many bases they reach or whatever. And so
You're participating.
You're participating and you're writing down the story of the game. And you know, if somebody goes to the bathroom and they come back and they're like, what did I miss? You can show them the scorecard and they can visualize what they missed. But I find that because you have to watch the game kind of closely, there's not a whole lot of room in your brain for anything else. And so it's just like me and the game and the sun and my scorecard. And that's my happy place.
And you have gone to a lot of these games by yourself. How is that experience different as far as descending on a baseball stadium to check it out solo versus with friends or family?
Well, as much as I love my friends and family, it is kind of nice going by myself because I get to do whatever I want. I get to show up however early I want. If I want to get there 2 hours early so I can walk the whole stadium, check out all the food, I can do that. I'm not inconveniencing anybody else. I might spend a little more money on the ticket to get a better seat. Then you miss out on the joy of sharing it with someone.
So what are the categories that you would say are sort of the main areas distinguishing one stadium experience from another?
Ooh, well, best food is definitely one. And something that I have learned.
How do you define best at a baseball
right,
stadium?
Right, so that's the big question, because people are always going to tell you to get that local thing. Like in Pittsburgh, it's the Primanti Brothers sandwich, which is this like okay sandwich that has french fries in it, and I got it and I was like, this is fine, but I bet there was something else here that was better. Or you go to LA and they're like, you have to get a Dodger dog, which is just a disgusting looking foot-long hot dog. Like, I don't need to eat that.
Does Kansas City have a thing?
I think lately what I've heard people talking about is the cheesy corn brisket nachos. Tachos? I think they're on tater tots.
Oh my God.
They're served in a giant helmet. It feels very Kansas City.
So yeah. We're just way past peanuts and cracker jacks.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So I like kind of doing my research ahead of time and not like, what is the thing to get? But what are the weird things that are here or what's new and exciting this year? So I was in Seattle a couple weeks ago and they had a new kind of like Caribbean place that was open. And so I got this delicious sandwich there, and not necessarily what someone would tell you to get when you went, but it was really good.
So, of course, the big question is, what stadium is objectively the very best one?
Well, Gina, as you know, I've put years of research into this, and I still...
Scientific.
It is scientific, and I still am willing to die on the hill that Kauffman Stadium is the best stadium.
Make the case.
Here's the case, is that it is unlike any other stadium. One of the main things that sets it apart is the huge parking lot, which some people think is like offensive and gross and against this city ideal of a downtown ballpark, which we've talked about on this show.
We have.
Because of me, probably. But the tailgating experience, in that the party starts early and it's a social experience. You go to the game with everybody you love and you eat food in the parking lot and then you go into the game. I thought that that was how every ballpark was. And when I started traveling the country and looking at all these ballparks, the first few I went to, I was like, yeah, but where do you tailgate? And it just is not a thing. It's not an expectation. So I think that that atmosphere lends itself to that kind of welcoming feeling.
But wait, is there any chance that Dallas is going to come in with a surprise win next weekend as the very last stadium you visit?
You know, I'm not optimistic. I think it'll be fine. I'm sure it'll be fine. I don't anticipate it somehow being the best stadium I've ever been to.
Okay, so now that we have come close to ruling that out, can you tell me more about why the K? Because tailgating is one piece mm-hmm. of it, and albeit it seems to be a very important piece to you, mm-hmm. but for it to be objectively the very best baseball stadium mm-hmm. in the country, I think we need more reasons.
I also think it's very well designed. And it is an older park, and I know it's gone through renovations, but a lot of the older parks are not enjoyable experiences. Wrigley, I nearly froze to death. Fenway Park, you have to, like, sit with your elbows in your lap because there's just not a lot of room. Kauffman is not as old as those stadiums, but it is older, and I think it's held up very well. The walkways are nice and wide. You can get a lot of people moving through them. You can walk all the way around the stadium, which is really rare. When I went to the Dodger Stadium, it's another one of these kind of, like, historic ballparks, and it's very closed in. You can only kind of move around your section. You can't go explore. Kauffman, I think... it's the stadium for people who aren't as into baseball. You know, you can go walk around, you can look at the fountains, you get this kind of specific feel of the fountains and the crown on the Jumbotron, and it feels like a specific place, and it feels like part of the city. And it's, I also, you know, people say that I'm biased, but I fell in love with I fell in love with baseball in D.C., which I think will disappoint people because I was going to a lot of Nationals games because you can get a $5 ticket. So they were easy to get to. They were affordable. And I went to a lot, and I still don't think it's the best stadium. I got to know it really well, but I don't think anything really sets it apart. It feels kind of like cut and paste from just a generic stadium.
Have you ever sat at the part of the K where you're like over by the fountains?
I haven't, because I have really specific places where I like to sit.
Where do you like to sit?
Well, I don't like sitting in the outfield because I want to see the drama that's happening at the plate. And so I like sitting between home base and third.
Are you going to do something? So you're going to Dallas this weekend to go to the only Major League Baseball stadium in the country that you have not yet been to. You're going to see the Royals play. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking as you're headed into this end of... not just a project, but if I may be so bold, a chapter in your life.
I know. It makes me kind of sad. I've kind of joked, like, well, what is there to live for now? And so I'm already looking, like, is it all the national parks before a certain age? Is it all 50 states before I turn 50? Like, I do feel like kind of having goal-oriented travel has been a really fun part of my life for the past few years. And I am going to be sad that it's over.
Is there something that you're going to do to tie it all together other than having this conversation, like write an ode to the best hot dog? Or
a lot of people ask me that, if I'm doing the same thing at every stadium, like, am I looking for the best hot dog? Am I taking the same picture at every stadium? And I think that's people wanting to, like, capitalize on your hobby and something that you love. Like, just, you can just do something because you love it. You don't have to turn it into a project. You don't have to generate content from it.
So, you don't have to make a blog.
No, you don't have to make a blog or a photo project or a documentary. You don't even have to do a talk show interview. But
but if we call you and ask, you totally should.
But I will. Yeah.
Melody Rowell, producer of KCUR's Central Standard, thank you.
Thank you.
Melody has one more stadium to visit. That'll be in Dallas on Saturday for a Royals game. And by the way, she is coming in 2 weeks ahead of her 30th birthday deadline. Our time is up. You can catch any of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard, where we archive all our past shows. You can also sign up to have them sent right to you on your phone or whatever device you like. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, passenger rail may be leaving rural Kansas, which would be crazy considering that trains are the whole reason European settlers even came to the state to begin with. That was a state previously deemed unsuitable for agriculture. That conversation tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, just for this last day. I know I keep saying that, but this time it's true. Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, Salisa Kalakal, Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.